And then I think for me, all the other steps are kind of similar. It's like health policy has been a big theme in my career. And I had no inkling that health policy was of interest to me. I didn't even really know what it was. I had no exposure. I had no framework or language to think about healthcare through that lens. And then I was at a series of lectures during what used to be called intersessions at UCSF. I was a UCSF medical student, and it was a third year of med school. I've been doing my rotations at the general and exposed to these big thorny societal problems and like the frustrations of, we really want to help this person more and they keep coming back.
And now from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Today, we are thrilled to have Dr. Ari Hoffman, an influential figure in healthcare and technology. He's currently served as the Chief Clinical Officer and Vice President of Population Health at Collective Health. He brings a unique blend of clinical expertise and technological innovation to the forefront of healthcare. His journey, originating from a biological sciences and medicine background, has seen him in pivotal roles at the University of California, San Francisco, and in health policy development at prestigious institutions like the NIH and the Center for Medical Technology Policy. His career is a testament to his dedication to improving healthcare system and his pursuit of value-based healthcare. His diverse experiences have enabled him to develop an acute understanding of the complexities and challenges faced by both healthcare providers and recipients. In this episode, we are exploring the convergence of clinical practice and health technology. Dr. Hoffman shares his insights on improving healthcare delivery, navigating health policy challenges, and the evolving role of technology in enhancing patient care. Join us as we explore the depth of his expertise and the impact of his work on the future of healthcare. Welcome, Ari. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Christine. Good to be here.
It's so nice to have you. So nice to have a fellow UCSF, although you left recently. I always like to start our conversation with your journey. I think you were in academic for a while, but now you're no longer academic. But tell us how your journey, how you decide that where you want to be in healthcare. Is this something that you knew from when you're five? You see somebody get doctor treatment and it's like, that's what I want to be, a doctor.
Not at all. I think like most things, there's a meandering path and sort of a one thing leads to a next. I will say one thing is that I'm still on the UCSF faculty and signing up for filling gaps in the clinical schedule, which I love so much to just stay grounded in the clinical care. So even though I'm not a part of the academic core faculty, I'm still practicing at UCSF and quite proud of that. With respect to my career path and how I got here, I think, I will say my dad's a doctor. And in fact, that was like the main reason that I sort of fought against the idea of medicine. Mm-hmm. I thought, no, that's so cliche to go into medicine just because my dad's a doctor. So, I really, there were some things about watching his career that are really inspiring to me, just in terms of his dedication to his work and his passion and love for his work, moral income, if you will, of just knowing that you're helping people and doing well in the world. And I know that helping people sounds cliche, but that is fundamentally what it's about, and trying to help individuals through their own healthcare journeys, no matter what your specialty is. And so that was always there for me. And I certainly had a lot of exposure to that. I also liked science, and for a while, I played with the idea of being what I think of as a real scientist. I did some research in a lab, a translational research lab at UCSF, actually, was in the Pacific Vascular Research Lab for 3 years between undergraduate and graduate school. And even before that, I spent summers doing research. Actually, it was Sam Hawgood's lab in summers as a college student, learning about, really to me, that was learning about how to think like a scientist, how to control of, you know, change a variable and control everything else about an experiment and monitor and measure things well, to connect the dots between the inquiry and what's needed in the world, the types of answers for problems we're looking for. And I still find that really valuable. I think that's applicable really broadly, whether you're in academic medicine, traditional research, or anywhere else in the world. It's about being data-driven. It's about being rigorous and thoughtful and having a dogged pursuit of the truth. Mm-hmm. And so I learned a lot from that experience. Really kind of didn't know whether I wanted to be in a more traditional healthcare role or medicine, and had a mentor from one of my professors from undergraduate who said to me, "You don't know anything about medicine, and you think you might know some ideas, but if you're thinking about it, you should spend some time with sick people. You should be in an actual healthcare environment and understand whether you like it or not." And I also wanted to make my Spanish skills better. I had learned Spanish in school, and I also just wanted to live abroad. And so I tried to put all of that together, and I went and volunteered through a program called Child Family Health International in Ecuador. So I lived in Quito in a homestay and learned a ton of Spanish and had a blast. Mm-hmm. And I went and worked at a hospital, a big, public, busy, chaotic hospital in Quito. And I loved it. I loved the hospital. And so that to me was a really important experience, to just be drawn into, in particular for me, the excitement of acute illness and the ability to do something and turn it around, not always, but to try, and to also recognize when not to try and to shift and be there with somebody. I was a low level volunteer, and I was helping clean up rooms, and I was helping hold people's hands during deliveries of babies. And it was an amazing experience for me. And it really invigorated me to come back to San Francisco and to apply for medical school at that point. And I had been out of college for a bit of time at that point. Mm-hmm. So that was really sort of like how it played into medicine. And then I think for me, all the other steps are kind of similar. It's like health policy has been a big theme in my career. And I had no inkling that health policy was of interest to me. I didn't even really know what it was. I had no exposure. I had no framework or language to think about healthcare through that lens. And then I was at a series of lectures during what used to be called intersessions at UCSF. I was a UCSF medical student, and it was a third year of med school. I've been doing my rotations at the general and exposed to these big thorny societal problems and like the frustrations of, we really want to help this person more and they keep coming back. And what, you know, I didn't have a way to think about that more structurally. And these lectures were all from local luminaries in San Francisco at UCSF, people like Steve Schroeder, mm-hmm. Diane Rittenhouse. I still remember it. And this is a long time ago. And I was really moved by their work. And it felt like the kind of like the concept map, the mind map for a lot of the problems, and a new way to think about it for me that was really exciting. And I had at that point thought I was going to be a clinical researcher. And I decided that I would sort of pivot what I wanted to do. I took some time again. I hit the pause button, stopped out of med school after third year. I'd gone off to DC and did a bioethics fellowship at the NIH, which ended up being a really health policy focused role because it was I was working with Zeke Emanuel, who had run the bioethics department there at the NIH for a time before he became a White House health policy advisor. I happened to be there in 2008 and campaigned for Obama and, you know, was there for the transition and the crafting of the ACA, worked with a couple other thought leaders in the sort of value construct space. Steve Pearson, who founded ICER, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, and Sean Tunis, who had been a CMS administrator and done similar work in the private sector nonprofit space, and just a tremendous learning opportunity for me. And it really was just a new exposure. I had no experience or grounding in this. All I had is I'm a passionate medical student and I've got this NIH fellowship. I've got some funding and I'm going to be free labor for you. And so I cold called people like Zeke Emanuel and he said, sure, you know, you can come work with me and be free labor with me. And it showed me that these new ideas can be new pursuits, and that sometimes these things that feel risky, like, oh, I'm not going to stay on the traditional track and I'm going to stop out of med school while I figure this thing out and explore it for a little while. Not drop out, just withdraw for a moment and come back to it. And that has been the rest of my career path all the way through. I'm going on far too long, but you get the idea that it's following that next pursuit, the one step after the other. And that ultimately led me to Collective Health last January. So I've been about 18 months.
Yeah. So it's interesting, you know, listening to how you make the decision of trying a new thing. And you mentioned a little bit also about fear. And there's every time there's a change, facing some unknown, there's always fear, no matter who you are. But what are the, you know, obviously you've done it many times, and how do you overcome that fear? What pushed you through to say?
Yeah, I think change is always hard, you know, and I think saying that I'm going to pick up and move across the country, or, you know, I've lived abroad a couple times, and after residency did a Peace Corps response program in Uganda, same thing, sold everything we owned, my wife and I, and moved across the world. I think the more you do it, it's like anything, the more you do it, the more comfortable you get with it. I'm going to bring in a totally non sequitur here, but I'll link it back, is that I have a background in improv theater. Mm. And one of the core principles of improv is saying yes to things, because that's how you create a scene from nothing. How you create a story from nothing is that you say yes to what's in front of you and you see where it goes. You let it take you forward. And it's interesting because when I've taught improv or done improv workshops with as a team building exercise, one of the things that comes up is the discomfort with just saying yes to things mm-hmm. as new opportunities, partly because of that fear of change, I think. And no, one of the things that's come up for me is just recognizing that why no feels good. No is safe. Mm-hmm. No is, you know, or the same. Why not changing is it's safe and it's stable. And there's something really good about that. That's important. And it's important to acknowledge it rather than say that that's bad. Yes, brings you adventures and new things and who knows, right? There's uncertainty in yes, and it's scary. I think one of the things that I've learned is that the risk is always overblown in my mind. Like, it feels way scarier and riskier to do anything big and different than it actually is. It's going to be okay. And especially, you know, I think it's easy for me to say I have a tremendous amount of privilege. I mean, being a UCSF medical student is already a place of privilege to say, like, I'm a third year med student and I have funding at the NIH, right? I don't want to gloss that over. I had that basis for that safety to be able to explore and be adventurous. So I'm very grateful for that safety net that provides me the ability to be a little bit more risky and say yes to things.
So Ari, you mentioned that you had experience in volunteering in keto, and then you obviously work at UCSF. I'm sure you see the stark difference. And you also mentioned that when you watched your dad being a doctor, then things that got you excited is like helping others. We hear a lot about physician burnout. Patients sometimes get angry with the doctors, and sometimes helping others can be a thankless job. I mean, do you see that here now, and how do you kind of keep on going to believe that this is something that is important and people still want to help other people when they become a doctor and they still can help people too?
Yeah, there's a ton in that question, Christine. I mean, I absolutely. So, you know, my international experience in Ecuador and Quito, as well as in Uganda and other places that I've been, still does inform some of the way that I see healthcare in America. And yes, it is very different. The value, the pursuit of value, which is better health at lower cost, is the same, right? That construct is the same. The lens of seeing it through a very resource poor versus very resource rich or concerned about overuse of services as opposed to more underuse of services, those are both versions of waste in healthcare and or low value in healthcare. And I think that it helps me to go back to those principles and of value and being doing right by people and to be grounded in the care of both the individual as well as this, for me, because of my policy experience and thinking more about health systems and systems leadership and operations and how these dots all connect. It, for me, I think also a lot about, I think it's been said that we need to, our system is sick. You know, it's the other patient, and we need to take care of that as and tend to that as much as we need to tend to the health of the individuals in front of us. And it's not either or, it's both and. It's really important to recognize that, because I think there are really important impacts that providers and many other types of leaders and actors in healthcare can contribute in all of those different spaces. And so, you know, when you talk about doctor burnout, it's a huge problem. And I think there was a recent article in the New York Times about the moral crisis of America's doctors that really struck me. It's from a researcher who had spent a lot of time focused around a very different type of workforce who feels this sense of moral crisis. And that was like people in working in prisons, for example. And so at first it was this sense like, what, that's weird. How are healthcare workers going to have that same sort of sense that what they're doing is not right, or they're being forced to do something that goes against sort of an inner moral compass? And I think we are increasingly seeing that, and we need to be clear-eyed about it. And we need to have some tough conversations about what those root causes are. You know, I mean, the AMA survey of doctors that showed reasons for burnout, a lot of the administrative burden is really up at the top of the list, and prior authorizations really high at that within that administrative burden. I think about that stuff a lot, and I think it's important that we all think about it regardless of where we sit in the system. And I also still see patients because I think it's really important to stay grounded in the patient care at the end of it. And I think that to be in a space like where I am in collective health, I think it's also really important for people who've walked the walk in the healthcare system, whether it's on the delivery side or in any other facet of this really complicated system that we've got, that we can bring that experience to whether it's health tech or other innovative companies and startups, right? Like I think when you make that shift, for me, that's been really important to stay grounded in that. And I think that's been well received as well. We talk about that a lot within the company and with clients and brokers and consultants. I think everybody really does want to do the right thing and at the end of the day. And it's on all of us to align the rest of the system around doing the right thing.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
Which brings me to the question, maybe it can help us hear a bit more about what does collective health do and why the work that collective health do is needed and what impact that will make difference to the system that you're saying that is kind of sick.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for asking. Collective health was founded about 10 years ago, and it really came out of one of our founders, Ali Diab, he's our CEO, had his own personal nightmarish experience with the accessing, paying for, understanding, navigating the entire healthcare experience for him after an emergency medical event. And, you know, he had been working at Google in the tech sector and has a deep product background and thought there could be a better way and, you know, worked together with other co-founders to build Collective Health. And at our core, we have a few main functions. So we serve as a third-party administrator, a TPA, for actually administering benefits. So we have that's a lot of work to build a TPA from nothing and to think about building it using a modern tech stack and all of the technical capabilities that come with that. But that's important as a really core sort of chassis, if you will, on which to build some of these other elements, which are integrated care management and a way to help people understand their healthcare benefits, navigate those benefits, access the care they need, match the available resources to their needs, and then all the way through the paying for the care experience. And then part of that is also connection to the rest of the healthcare ecosystem, to use the buzzword, the ecosystem of some of that is these other companies, right? So we have hundreds of integrations, and some of that is the companies like mental health or primary care or musculoskeletal startup companies who are actually providing important services and making sure that we have the appropriate connections depending on what is available to the patient who's at the end of this. And the other parts of the connection are to the rest of the incumbent healthcare system, the delivery systems, the networks. And so that's a complicated array of stuff. It's a complicated, all the data is complicated. And our job is to try and make it affordable to both the employer and the employee, transparent. So really, there's a lot under transparency, from the price transparency to the data that underpins it, to the plans itself and the understanding of the plans, and how we actually communicate down to the content and the words, like how this is actually communicated. Because if you've ever had an explanation of benefits, an EOB from a traditional healthcare insurance company, you know that it's like an impenetrable, way too long, way too jargonful document at the end of which you're not sure what to do. It just completely...
I don't think anybody read it anymore.
They end up in the recycling bin as a result, right? And that's not contributing to anything. So it's down to that level of the thoughtful design, the intuitive use, the simple language, and then the supports through digital tools and through the human supports. We do have a number of human supports and services that we provide as well.
Can you give us maybe like a case, like example, like I'm an employee, at UCSF, assuming UCSF is part of the collective health. Say I have a certain condition that I need treatment. What are the journey for me if UCSF is using collective health?
Great. And maybe someday it will. I think there's a lot to say about that. So I think it starts at enrollment, right? You're enrolling in a plan. It's open enrollment. We are the first thing you see. So the enrollment portal is through Collective Health. And then there's your plan options are presented by us to you. There's a mobile version, a web version. You're in the enrollment portal. Then there's some opportunity to help you understand your plan selection, and you select a plan and you register for our member portal. Now you have an app if you want to use that on the phone or the web version, and that's the digital part. And those digital tools include your provider search, all of your plan details, all of your additional benefits, whether that's like, you know, that's often referred to as point solutions in the self-funded employer space, right? What other tack on services, whether it might be a mental health app, but it might be a whole brick and mortar provider system. And so all of those things are displayed there. And those are also made evident to people in the search. So we are able to integrate those things into the search. We're able to show things like quality scores, mm-hmm. And, you know, help people understand the selection of their providers and connect their needs to their resources. So there's a lot that goes into that. There's a lot of behavioral economics that I'd love to talk mm-hmm. about sometime. Mm-hmm. We can create nudges in the portal, reminders for things like closing care gaps.
Okay.
And then if there's questions, we have member advocates who help members understand their benefits, navigate their benefits, connect to care. And we have a complex case management team, a care management team, that's a multidisciplinary clinician team who can help with some of the more clinically based or complicated navigation components. Like, for example, somebody who's got a chronic inflammatory disease on an infusion who wants to get that infusion at home. And that can be a number of phone calls and steps to take to arrange the proper logistics. And so our team can help mm-hmm. help you or the employee mm-hmm. through those steps.
How is it different though? So like UCSF, we have Cigna, HealthNet, and Kaiser. So mm-hmm. somebody like HealthNet, can they do what you guys do too? Saying that, hey, these are all the things.
Yeah, it's a great question. So a couple things that are different. So one is we don't create our own network. So we are riding network rails, if you will. And the way you can think about that is the analogy that I like is the same as the iPhone can be on Verizon or AT&T. Our product and service platform can ride on different networks, whether that's Anthem, Cigna, right? And so primarily we're mostly on the Blues. Cigna is the national. We're always expanding that. There's a whole number of other ways that this is beneficial to employers. So one is that we're bringing together medical, pharmacy, dental, and vision. And we have an unbundled approach to that, meaning that you can keep your medical network, but swap your pharmacy benefit manager, or PBM, for example, if that's part of your clinical strategy as an employer to help save plan spend, mm-hmm. for example. And that may not be possible with some of the big networks because they own their own PBM, right? So they're not going to offer you different. It's not an unbundled offering. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the ways that it's different. Another way, as we already sort of touched on, is the member experience is very different. the insurance industry is one of the least trusted things, entities in the United States, right? There was a recent like popular survey that caught my eye that was highlighting how insurance industry is below pharma, which is way below everything else, right? And of course, doctors and nurses are still well-trusted, thankfully. And I think that the, you know, and the delivery system still has a lot of that public trust. And so we recognize that. And we are not seen by the employees, the membership, as the same as the Cignas of the world, or the, you know, the sort of incumbent insurance networks. I think as a result of being a little more tech forward and having more intuitive digital tools, having design and a technical infrastructure that's built this side of the millennium, a product development team working on features and feature enhancements, always thinking about the user research and the user feedback loop, I just think that whole experience is very different from a traditional insurer. So as an employee, you know, one of the things as an employee, it's just a more pleasant experience for one.
You all want that.
It offers us the ability to work with people directly in a way that I think insurance incumbents really struggle. They really struggle to engage. I mean, their digital portal use is terrible. I mean, some of them, the statistics on these things are abysmal. And the engagement for care management from a payer side is always low. So, you know, the fact that people look to us before they access care, and we actually track that as a very important metric, and we're seeing 70% of our claims are preceded by engagement with us, that's an enormous opportunity to... That's when it matters, right? You're engaged, you're thinking about it, but you haven't already done the thing. So now you have the opportunity to ask questions like, well, what's going to be the most cost effective for me and affordable? And where can I go that is going to have less of an impact on my out-of-pocket spend? Those types of conversations can be had, and we can help people, whether that's in the digital side or over the phone, traditional human interaction. It's building that trust is a huge part of what we've done and what we think about. And I think, you know, that that has people to build that trust. People need to know about us. They need to use us. They need to really love us. And then we need to be able to execute on their behalf in a way that they know that we're going to walk the walk for them. So I think all of those things are different in a collective health experience from a traditional payer experience.
And from the point of view of a provider, how is that helping them?
It's a great question. Because we're not curating our own the network, the providers are still being paid. The negotiations with the network are the same. The providers are still being paid through the networks. We are doing something called adjudicating the claims to figure out what, you know, that the right benefits are applied and that the payment from the employee is appropriate, et cetera. But then that goes back out to the network who pays the providers. And so it's of less of an impact on the provider side. I have a lot to say about where this goes. I think the way we think about things like appropriateness and how to manage appropriateness and how we partner with plan sponsors, the employers who are purchasing this amazing amount of healthcare in the United States and so frustrated and yet don't know how to really move the puck effectively against, you know, if you're even if you're a really big company, you're small compared to United or Anthem, right? And so it's hard. It's really hard. I have a tremendous amount of empathy for benefit leaders and the challenge of their job. They're basically trying to run a whole health plan out of off the desk of a, you know, even a big company. It's a really, really big challenge. And there's so much that is really outside of their sphere of influence or control. And so we're in communication with those people and with the consultants who help define the clinical strategy that then we bring to life. And you know, we're able to come to the table and inform with data and with transparency and say, okay, here, let's challenge some of these traditional notions around UM. And I was really glad to see Cigna announce that they're cutting how many prior authorizations by 25%. That was, I think, just the other day. There have been some efforts in terms of like proving quality and appropriateness, and then you don't need any PAs. There's a real crisis around some of this stuff, going back to that AMA survey and provider burnout. But I think don't let a good crisis go to waste. Out of that is coming some good solutioning. And I think that the optimist in me says the combination of better data, better transparency, better tools like the ones we're trying to build that's an opportunity for us to think about appropriateness in a much more personalized and targeted fashion, and to try to put appropriateness back in the provider-patient relationship and take it out of these eye-pokey, blunt tool approaches of just like throwing tons of PAs. Because traditionally, that was just the only way, that was like one of the only tools payers and plan sponsors had to get in front of care to make sure that it was appropriate. And I think the suite of tools are changing. Mm-hmm. And as that changes, we're all in a position to think in a more enlightened way, I think, if you will, to try to solve some of these thorny problems. And that will impact the provider experience a lot. I think about that a lot, especially when it comes up around UM and PAs.
Yeah.
I know what that feels like as a provider.
Well, I'm glad that good thing that you still stay in the clinical, because at least remind you all the pain about that as well every day. And so I want to do a segue, because we are running out of time here. One of the things that I always like to ask the question is like, you've done all this work, a lot of experience. What are the lessons learned that you took from way back, since you mentioned that you worked with Sam Hoggart when he was still a PI? And I was curious to know, like, what did you learn from Sam Hoggart at that time that kind of shaped who you are?
Oh, wow. Sam, I hope you're listening. I learned a tremendous amount from him and so many others along the way. And that is one of my takeaway lessons from my whole career path, is the importance of mentorship and cultivating and collecting mentors and keeping them over time. I cannot tell you how important that's been for me. And I mean, Sam in particular, he trusted his people, and he gave his people the resources that they needed to do their jobs well. He led through thoughtful questions. And I still remember that. Like, he was able to take in a lot of inputs and in these PI meetings, research meetings, and then really guide the team by asking us the probing questions that we all arrive at the sort of solution or path forward or more organically. And that is a really important skill. And, I think I spoke to it a little bit earlier too. I think for me, some of the most important other skills or take-home lessons, I would say, are being structured and having a mind map or a concept or a framework. I think these sort of basic principle frameworks really helped me. And I was not sure how much some of my sort of health systems training at UCSF, using Lean as the main framework for thinking about systems improvement, would immediately translate into my role at Collective Health. It's been by far and away the most useful tool. And things like SMART goals, right? Like, just, I know it's like cringy because like the med students get ground into them and then they like start to roll their eyes when you talk about SMART goals. But if any of you all med students or other students are listening and you're rolling your eyes about SMART goals, just know it has come in very handy in my job at Collective Health to think through really data-driven, outcomes-oriented, structured approaches to improvement and to help others think in that way as well. So I think those would be mentors, listening, taking in inputs and leading with questions, and having a structured approach to getting things done and sort of relying on those first principles. That's to me, those three all sit on top of trying to do right by people. And at the end of the day, we all have to keep that moral compass headed pointed in the right direction.
That's great. Thank you. Well, last question. This is I'm testing this question with you.
Great.
What is something that others value that you don't?
Ooh. Something that others value that I don't. I'm going to say in the commercial space, this gets talked about a lot, but there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of hyperbole. And I guess what I would say is that I don't value shiny objects or widgets for widgets' sake. And I value creation, right? And I think a lot of the innovation has so much potential. And I think we don't do it any good service when we try to so heavily oversell it and do it without backing it up with transparent, understandable, defendable methods. And I think, you know, the entire industry, the commercial side of the industry and the health tech sector could use to take a page out of the sort of academic playbook. There are plenty of holes you could poke in that too, but I think just having a rigorous evaluation and defendable, reproducible methods as core principles is so important. And I would love to see more of that. I think there's plenty of great examples. I'm not trying to throw everybody under the bus here at all. And I know that it's hard and it's time consuming and it takes tons of just totally inglorious work around data, you know, transformation and standardization, but all that's going to pay off. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's going to be the innovation that truly creates value for people that's going to win out over the hyperbolic sales pitch.
That sounds good. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing your insight. Thanks for sharing what you learned from Sam Haggett when you guys were both young.
Thank you, Christine.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.